In Matthew chapter 5, Jesus pronounced 8 blessings on those who would follow Him, whose lives would be changed to conform to what God wanted them to be. We call these the Beatitudes. And the word blessing that He used here literally meant, in Hebrew thinking, to be loved, honored, and rewarded by God. And so Jesus talks about those who are poor in spirit, those who are meek and humble, those who are brokenhearted because of their lack of a right relationship with God, those who are hungry and thirsty to do what's right, those who are merciful to their fellow man, those who are pure-hearted, and those who love peace and make peace, not only between man and man, but between man and God. But then that 8th blessing we saw last week is not something we are to be or we become, but something that will happen to us. Blessed are those who are persecuted for My name and for righteousness' sake. It might be hard for us to imagine why the world would want to persecute people who have the kind of attributes and characteristics that we would normally consider to be the very finest traits that any person could have. People that are humble, not proud. People that are hungry to do what's right, not desirous of doing wrong things. People who are trying to make peace, not war. Why would the world want to persecute people like that? The world does not want to persecute us because we are meek, are peacemakers, or because we hunger and thirst for righteousness. They want to persecute us because we are with Jesus. And we promote the same thing Jesus came here to accomplish. That's why. And so after Jesus finishes the Beatitudes, as we often refer to them, He lets us know why the world wants to persecute us in verses 13 through 16 of Matthew 5. Here's what He says. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. You are the light of the world. A city on a hill cannot be hidden. Neither do people light a lamp and put it under a bowl. Instead, they put it on its stand, and it gives light to everyone in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. Jesus' intention for us is that we be salt and light in our world. That's what He came for. He came to influence and change the world. And He came to shine light into darkness. And now He tells us, He tells those who were gathered around Him that day, down the side of the mountain when He's giving this message, that they are the salt of the earth. And it's interesting how we've used that in our culture today. You know, that term, the salt of the earth, is actually a part of English nomenclature. In other words, a common phrase in our language. What it means, you're just the good people. You're just the good, common, ordinary people of this world. That's not what Jesus meant. That's not what He meant when He said that. He meant by that, you are the people who change things. You are the people who influence things. You are the people who make the difference in a world that is otherwise unsalted. Same way with light. You are the light of the world. Let's look at these two things for a few moments. Here in both of these, it's clear, I think, that Jesus is talking about the influence that people of the kingdom of heaven have on this world. For that's who He's talking to. He's talking to people who want to be a part and who are a part of the kingdom of heaven on earth. So He first of all talks about salt. You are the salt of the earth. But then he goes on to talk about what happens when the salt doesn't have the effect it should, when somehow it's changed, when somehow it doesn't do its job. Then it's not useful for anything else because it only has one purpose. And when it doesn't accomplish that purpose, then it has no use, no value. When we go back into the Old Testament and look at salt in their world and how salt was used, I think it's very revealing to us. A good Bible dictionary would help us with this. And I've just sort of boiled this down and condensed it down for us this morning. But here's some of the things we see in the Old Testament. For example, we see that salt was used to savor and to flavor things, and even to preserve them. And so, for example, in Job 6 and verse 6, it talks about food without salt and how tasteless it is. Some of us maybe go a little overboard in how much salt we put on our food, don't we? And so the medical experts warn us against that, that too much salt leads to unhealthy situations. But all of us, even those medical experts, realize the value of having just the right amount of salt, because it enhances, it savors, it flavors. And even a lot of salt can be used and was in the ancient world, including their world, often to preserve things. They would pack things in salt. They would coat things with salt and it would preserve it. The ancients, before modern refrigeration and so forth, would often take things like their meat and they would take it and pack it in salt, and that would keep it from spoiling for long periods of time while they were making trips across the ocean by ship or traveling from St. Louis, Missouri to Oregon by wagon train and things like that, because it was a preservative. It was in the ancient world and it still is today. And so salt was used to savor, flavor, and preserve things. But even beyond that, we find, for example, in Ezekiel chapter 16 and verse 4, it mentions that when a child was born, that child was rubbed with salt. You might think, what would they do a thing like that for? Salt served as a simple form of antiseptic to cleanse and to protect that newborn that's just come out into the world. And they didn't have modern antibiotics and all the other kind of things that we use today, but they had discovered by long practice that when a child was born, as soon as it was born, among the things they would do once they would wash it off was then to put salt over the entire body. So it was used to protect and to cleanse. Then we turn to their worship. And we notice that when we read in the book of Leviticus and in Exodus, that they always use salt as a part of their sacrifices to God. It tells us, for example, in not in Exodus and Leviticus, but over in Ezekiel it mentions, in Ezekiel 43:24, that their burnt offerings had salt put on them. A burnt offering was a worship offering. It's an offering that was made not for sin. That was a sin sacrifice. But the burnt offering was one that was given to God to honor Him because He is God. But salt was always put on their burnt offerings. It tells us in Leviticus chapter 2 and verse 13 that every time they made a grain offering, which was an offering which basically said to God, "You have given us our daily food, and we honor you by offering a representation of that in this grain offering," salt was always on it. God said, "Do not offer me a grain offering without salt on it." And then again, in Exodus chapter 30, the incense that they used to burn in the morning and in the evening as they worship God, that actually represented the prayers of people going up to God, always had salt mixed with it. So for God, He saw their worship of Him through their sacrifices involving even salt. There was something about that salt that had some kind of symbolic significance. They certainly didn't need it to savor or flavor these offerings, and they didn't need it to cleanse them or make them antiseptic. But God wanted salt on them. And perhaps this is the reason why. On several occasions in the Old Testament, God talks to His people about there being a covenant of salt between Him and them. Certainly those worship practices they had was representative of the covenant, the relationship between God and His people. And He required them to put salt on all these different things as they worshiped Him. And He calls this a covenant of salt. It represented the commitment and the obligation to provide and care for someone. Even today, I'm told that among the still nomadic peoples of the Arabian Peninsula and so forth, and we mostly focus on the ones that have all the oil and all the money and so forth, but there's still plenty of just plain, simple, ordinary people living in the Arabic-speaking countries who are, some of them are nomadic, some of them are small farmers, but they're just ordinary folks. Still among their people today, if someone is invited into their home or into their tent to eat with them, salt is an important part, a symbolic part of them offering this person food. If they offer you salt when you sit down to eat with them, they're saying, we're in a covenant with each other, a friendship. And in the Old Testament, God uses that to describe the provision He made for the priest when the offerings were made. A certain portion was set aside for the priest and their families. And God said concerning that in Numbers 18:19, this gift I'm providing for you is a covenant of salt between me and you. I'm providing for you, God says, because you are my people. Later, He will say in 2 Chronicles chapter 13 about David, the king. God made this promise to David that he would have descendants sitting on the throne after him, and in fact that there would be no other king over God's people except descendants of David. That's very important for us because when Jesus comes, the last and greatest king, who is he? A son of David. He's the last and great king, and he is the fulfillment of that promise that God made to David. But in 2 Chronicles 13:5, God says, this promise I have made to David about his descendants always sitting on the throne is a covenant of salt between me and him. So when we start talking about salt in the Bible, we're being asked to think of something beyond just what's in the salt shaker on our table. We're being asked to think about salt in the way these people thought about salt. Not just as something, although it did, that savored and flavored their food or helped preserve their food, but something that ensured that their newborn children were protected when they first are born, to be a part of everything that they did as they worship God in their sacrifices, to think about even the daily provision that God had made for His priest as being a covenant of salt with God, and even that the fact they have a king sitting on the throne that is God's appointed man is because of a covenant of salt between God and man. And so when Jesus then says to those people who already are thinking this way about salt, you are the salt of the earth. Yes, He's telling them that it's my intention that if you're going to be a part of the kingdom of heaven, that you are what savors and flavors this earth. You are what turns that which is not palatable or tasteful into something that is enjoyable to God. You savor it, you flavor it. But more than that, you also are expected to be those who help preserve it. Don't we know that when there's not enough godly people somewhere, that something can't be saved? What happened in the days of Noah? What happened when it got down to only 8 people who still honored and worshiped God? The Noah movie came out this week, you know. And that's the point of the movie. I'm still amazed that they got that past the critics and actually is in the theaters. Because it says God is destroying the world in Noah's day because there is so much wickedness and there's so few righteous. Only eight. There weren't enough people left to savor, flavor, and save that world. Jesus says of us, you are the salt of the earth. We have a purpose in being here as God's people. We're to make a difference in this world. And we're to help try to save it or preserve it. But more than that, looking at these other uses of salt, we think about the fact that salt is that which cleanses, is almost an antiseptic in the ancient world. And as the salt of the earth, we are intended to help clean up this wickedness that's in our world. Not because we can forgive sin, and not even because we have any power of our own, but because the Lord Jesus Christ, working in us and through us, is trying to accomplish this in our world. It means that when we worship God, our offerings to Him can be acceptable because we're salt. When we worship Him with our spiritual burnt offerings, when we worship Him with our grain offerings, in effect, our contribution we take up on Sundays is the church's equivalent to the grain offering of the Old Testament. We tend to think it's only like the tithes of the Old Testament, but more than the tithes, the grain offerings also were representative of what we do today with our offerings. But because we're salt, God will accept those offerings. And even as we offer up our prayers to God, like the incense rose from the burning of the fragrant offerings morning and evening to God, they're acceptable to God because we're salt. The salt had to be in it before it would be acceptable to God. God wasn't into just forms and externals. It wasn't enough just to offer a burnt offering. It wasn't enough just to offer a grain offering. It wasn't enough just to burn the incense. Unless the heart of the people was right, God didn't accept it. That's still true today. Whatever we offer to God today is only acceptable to Him because we are salt. We have become what He wants us to be. And just like salt in the Old Testament was a covenant symbol, we are in covenant with God today. We are in a covenant of salt with Him today in which He says to us, I will provide for you and take care of you as long as you're salt. And the king you have reigning over you, my own son, is the king of the covenant of salt. So when Jesus was telling these folks that you are the salt of the earth, that carried some pretty significant ideas that had already been in their thinking and in their culture for hundreds of years before Jesus came. And He's tapping into that and He's emphasizing that if they're going to be people of the kingdom of heaven, they have to become what salt was in their everyday life to their world. They needed to savor it and flavor it, preserve it, be antiseptic to it, be acceptable worship for it, be the people of the covenant that God had put into this world. But there's a problem. Salt, which chemically, literally, is sodium chloride, NaCl. I learned that in chemistry in high school. And it's a very stable product. It's rare that you can find it breaking that bond between the sodium and the chloride atoms and they being pulled apart and recombined with something else. But it is possible. But more than that, what happens is salt often gets mixed in with other things and is no longer useful or usable as salt. It was salt in as pure a form as they could get it that actually could do the things that they needed salt to do. When it was mixed with other chemicals, other compounds, and so it's together with them, it became much less effective or even ineffective. And so Jesus says, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled by men. It became just something they threw along their roads and their paths to be walked on. The Lord's telling us that we are to be salt. And we cannot be diluted or mixed in with the things of this world that will remove that saltiness. You are the salt of the earth. I think because of the time, we'll save until next time. You are the light of the world. But Jesus is being pretty serious right up front, isn't he? We've already pointed out that the whole background to this Sermon on the Mount, as we call it, is people's expectation was that Jesus, if he really was the one talked about in the Old Testament who was to come, and many were already convinced of that, that he was here to raise an army, to be a military leader, a general, and to lead God's people in victory over the Romans and establish them as a great political power in their world. And yet very early on, Jesus is talking about just exactly the opposite of that. That the world is not going to be conquered by military might and power, but by salt and light. He's actually describing what sounds like a paradox. The exact opposite of what you would expect. Something that seems at first sound as being inexplicable. And yet, his people are not to be military geniuses and warriors in the sense that they go out and fight against the forces of other nations in this world, but instead we are those people who make all the difference by being salt. And that's what we've been called to be. I suppose our world thinks that it doesn't need us. In fact, it goes beyond that, doesn't it? The world persecutes us. Jesus says that's what awaits those who will be salt and light. Because the world doesn't see that it needs us. And again, we say, and it opposes us not because we're meek and merciful and desire peace, but it persecutes us for his sake because they have rejected Jesus and his righteousness. And so unless the world actually hears about Jesus and his righteousness from us, it wouldn't have any reason to persecute us.